Blog Talk Radio.
I think there's nothing that terrifies the people running the political system in America more than the danger of democracy breaking out. If you look at the violent reaction they had to a bunch of camps in public parks, we still can't meet in public without being physically assaulted, despite the fact that we have this thing called the First Amendment.
David Graeber on democracy and Occupy Wall Street on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Denise in brief from the United Nations. The UN and partners have launched a more than $5 billion funding appeal for Afghanistan to shore up collapsing basic services there. 22 million people need assistance inside the country and 5.7 million require help beyond its borders, according to humanitarians. In Geneva, UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths said that $4.4 billion was needed to pay health workers and others directly, not the de facto authorities.
This is a stopgap, an absolutely essential stopgap measure that we are putting in front of the international community today. Without this being funded, there won't be a future. We need this to be done. Otherwise, there will be outflow. There will be suffering.
Filippo Grandi, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, also appealed for $623 million to support displaced people and host communities in five neighboring countries. Without sufficient action to help Afghanistan and its neighbors now, Mr. Grandi warned that next year the amount needed could double to $10 billion. $20 billion weather and climate emergencies hit the United States last year, and 2021 was the fourth warmest year in the U.S. on record, the UN World Meteorological Organization, WMO, said on Tuesday. The WMO is now busy crunching those findings from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration with data from six other leading international weather services around the world to determine just how warm 2021 was. These include the European Union's Copernicus Earth Observation Program, which has just announced that 2021 was the fifth warmest year on record, and that the past 7 years have been the seventh warmest on record. A week after the start of riots in Kazakhstan, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday that nearly 10,000 people remain in detention, according to the authorities. With calm returning to the country, OHCHR spokesperson Liz Throssell called for prompt and independent investigations into the unconfirmed deaths of 164 people in the protests, the majority in the main city of Almaty, and 17 or 18 law enforcement officers.
All those arrested and detained solely for exercising these rights should be released immediately. Now, of course, we have seen the damage and destruction, for example, in Almaty. We've seen the burnt-out buildings. So clearly, among these, and we don't have a breakdown of who is in detention. It is a huge number, as I say. But clearly, there will be some people who have been arrested and likely to be charged.
Ms. Throssell noted that armed individuals appeared to be present during the demonstrations, which were sparked by now-reversed energy price hikes. She also urged the Kazakh authorities to grant all detainees access to a lawyer and to allow national ombudspersons to visit places of detention to prevent any torture and ill treatment and to monitor the situation of detainees.
Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Take a break from the pandemic. Earth is calling. Laughing gas unexpectedly rose out of the warming Arctic. The third major warming gas, nitrous oxide, is emerging from permafrost, another unexpected feedback. From Finland, we hear from lead author Dr. Maija Marushak. Then another shock. New science connects disappearing sea ice to increasing wildfires in the western United States. And there were a lot of those this year. This is big news from Dr. Yufei Zhou in our second interview. Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Yet another dangerous global warming feedback has been uncovered in the Arctic. It's nitrous oxide, the greenhouse gas that doesn't get enough respect. Yes, the major driver of climate change is carbon dioxide, as 63% of human-induced emissions. Methane is next at 17%. Nitrous oxide, more powerful but more rare, lags behind, counting only 6% of greenhouse gases from people's activities. Two things. With our future climate on a knife edge, that 6% could tip us into changes difficult to survive. And, like carbon dioxide and methane, nitrous oxide emissions are rising steeply in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution and accelerating. 6% of a rapidly growing total burden becomes a larger and larger amount. So what is nitrous oxide? It is a gas where two nitrogen atoms are bound tightly with one oxygen atom. For humans, nitrous oxide is used in dentistry as a pain reliever and for sedation. It is actually an asphyxiant. Strangely, nitrous oxide also triggers the laugh reflex. It is laughing gas. Nitrous oxide was discovered in 1799 by a 20-year-old chemist, Humphrey Davy, and he and his friends soon tried it out for a giggle. In the 1800s, traveling medicine shows and auditoriums blasted whole rooms full of people with nitrous oxide to create uproarious crowds. It still returns periodically as a hip party thing, but remember, nitrous oxide is a dangerous asphyxiant that can be deadly. One other thing, according to Wikipedia, quote, a 2009 study suggested that nitrous oxide emissions was the single most important ozone-depleting emission, and it was expected to remain the largest throughout the 21st century, end quote. So it's not a good thing to have more of it. The basic element nitrogen is cycled through soil, plants, and our bodies, and then back into the atmosphere. The process of nitrogen being captured by microorganisms is called nitrification. When those microorganisms or other ones release it again to make a gas, that is denitrification, where it unites with oxygen, escaping as the potent greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. Here is the new wrinkle. Until recently, science agreed the big plays in the nitrogen cycle are in the tropics. The Arctic has lots of nitrogen frozen in the soils, but it lacks the microorganisms that would free it. Well, thank goodness for that. But new science finds a warming Arctic and thawing permafrost. Serious nitrous oxide emissions are starting up. That means humans can emit even fewer greenhouse gases before we lose our livable planet because we have this northern feedback loop developing. So let's get to that new science. You hear about carbon dioxide and methane flowing into the atmosphere as permafrost thaws. But there is more. Nitrous oxide, the greenhouse gas we hardly ever hear about. It is pound for pound 300 times more powerful for warming than carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide stays in the atmosphere for around 114 years. Humans induce about 43% of nitrous oxide gas reaching the atmosphere. The rest is natural, so to speak. But nitrous oxide from natural sources is getting a boost as the northern top of the planet thaws. New science published December 2021 in the journal Nature explores vast lands where powerful greenhouse gases emerge in what could be a positive climate feedback. Dr. Maya Marushik is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland. She authored and co-authored dozens of works on the Arctic. From Finland, Maya, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for the invitation.
How much warming comes from nitrous oxide in the atmosphere?
Nitrous oxide is the third most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide and methane, and its contribution to the global warming caused by greenhouse gases is about 6%.
6%?
Yes.
Okay. Is nitrous oxide increasing in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and methane are?
It is increasing, and it is increasing more rapidly during the past four decades than it was increasing before. So compared to pre-industrial times, it has increased about 20% or a bit.
That's quite a bit. There's a lot of nitrogen reappearing in the Arctic as the permafrost thaws, but previously scientists considered Arctic nitrogen less important than emissions that could come from the tropics. What has changed?
That is very true, that traditionally people haven't been very concerned about permafrost nitrogen. And there is a good basis for thinking that in Arctic, this nitrous oxide doesn't matter so much. That is because Arctic is very cold environment, as we all know, and you have a lot of nitrogen in the soil. as you have a lot of carbon too. But it is there, quite well conserved by the cold temperatures and also by permafrost, so really locked from the microbial decomposition. And it has been so before that the nitrogen availability is so low because of the slow nitrogen mineralization from soil organic matter. So the availability for microbes and plants of nitrogen has been really low earlier. But now Arctic is changing very rapidly, as we know. So it is very quickly warming, twice as quick as the globe on average, or locally it can be even 3 times or 4 times quicker than the globe is warming. And that is causing big changes in this nitrogen availability from soil organic matter. So this nitrogen mineralization, which produces the mineral nitrogen that can be used by plants and microbes, that is now increasing. And also this permafrost nitrogen that has been locked from decomposition, that now becomes available when the permafrost thaws. And now there can be more nitrogen available that can be immediately used by plants and microbes. And this can cause now the leak to the atmosphere as nitrogenous gases, including nitrous oxide.
It can be difficult to grasp what this is about. So you led the new paper published in Nature December 7, 2021. The title is Thawing Yadoma Permafrost is a Neglected Nitrous Oxide Source. What is Yadoma?
Okay, Yadoma is one of the most important permafrost types that we know. So there is permafrost peat and then Yadoma, which contain very huge carbon pools. And Yadoma, that means these kind of fine-grained, organic-rich sediments that were accumulated over large areas in Siberia and Far East Russia and Alaska and Yukon during the late Pleistocene, so the last ice age. So most of the northern hemisphere was covered by ice sheets. But between those ice sheets, there are these mammoth grasslands. So they were dry and cold environments where windblown sediments were accumulated. And after the accumulation, they were quickly frozen. And that's how Yadoma has been generated. And it occurs now as these very thick deposits. So it can be several tens of meters, so even 50, 60 meters deep deposits of this late ice age organic material. And when that thaws, then this carbon and nitrogen from Yadoma becomes available for microbes.
Is the Yadoma the actual wedges of ice that is stuck in Arctic land, or is it the landscape that contains those icy wedges?
So Yadoma means these deposits, so this kind of soil material, fine-grained soil material that contains then carbon and nitrogen. And you mentioned the ice wedges, so they are something very characteristic for Yadoma. When Yadoma was accumulated, it was this kind of polygonal mammoth tundra where it was accumulated, and typical for this polygonal tundra are that it forms these ice wedges, so big clumps of pure ice that are formed in cracks in the soil. So Yadoma consists of these Yadoma sediments, sediment material, and then these ice wedges of pure ice. And why these ice wedges are important, so they don't contain so much carbon or nitrogen, but they make Yadoma very vulnerable for thaw. So when Yadoma thaws, these ice wedges, they are melted away, so it's almost pure water, and they can comprise even 85% of the total soil volume in these Yadoma sediments. So when those ice wedges are melted away and the Yadoma also thaws, a big volume disappears with those ice wedges, and that causes very catastrophic thawing and ground collapse, which can then reveal very deep soil profiles completely in a short time. And in our recent study, we really studied this kind of Yeromo exposure, so collapse sites where tens of meters of Yeromo are exposed in riverbanks.
Is there a lot of this nitrogen-rich Yeromo in the world, and where is it?
Yes, there is a lot of Yeromo in the world. So the Yeromo region covers more than 1 million square kilometers across the northern hemisphere, and it occurs over large areas in Siberia and Russian Far East and Alaska and Yukon.
And there's another common misunderstanding, and it's beautifully addressed in your new paper. To find past atmospheric conditions in the deep past, we know that scientists measure gases trapped in bubbles in the glaciers. But the nitrous oxide you warn about is not just ready sitting there in bubbles, ready to rise up from thawed ground. Please describe the process required after the thaw when nitrogen can go airborne as nitrous oxide.
This is a very good question, and it brings us to the main players of these permafrost feedbacks to climate change. So, I mean, no, the microbes. In our paper, we could very nicely link the microbial community in this thawed Yeromo sediments with these nitrous oxide fluxes. So we noticed that right after thaw, Yeromo sediments, they don't produce a lot of nitrous oxide. But it takes about 10 years when the sediments are dried and stabilized and revegetated. And together with these changes, there are big changes in the microbial community. And we saw increased abundance of those functional genes which contribute to nitrous oxide production in the soils. There are two main processes producing nitrous oxide in soils, nitrification and denitrification. And we found increased relative abundance of these nitrifier genes that produce nitrate. And then we also found increased abundance of denitrifier genes, which then use the nitrate to produce nitrous oxide. Yeah, these are very interesting dynamics, what happens after permafrost thaw, because often it's the case that permafrost is lacking some of the important functional microbial groups. But then in a real environment, the microbes can become abundant that were lacking in the first place.
It's kind of a small revelation, really, to me in your paper, because if you need the right set of microorganisms in the soil and they're not there when the ground first thaws, that kind of means that, like the birds and the fish and the plants, microbes are pushing towards the poles as the ground warms and thaws.
Well, this is kind of what is happening. It's not this kind of northward migration like can happen for the tree line or for the birds or some plant species, but it is so that what we find in intact permafrost before it has been thawed, that doesn't mean that nothing else can access there. So microbes, they can be moving within the ground with water flows, and they can be also dispersed by air. So more or less it is so that any microbial groups, they can start to thrive in this thawed permafrost with time. So depending on the environment, is it wet or dry, what kind of conditions are there? So the right microbes will find there. And with Yeromo, which is nitrogen-rich sediment, it makes sense that nitrogen-transforming microbes will find their way there. And in right conditions, they will start to produce nitrous oxide.
At the 2012 meeting for the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver, I was there. I listened to a conversation among permafrost experts. And even then, just 10 years ago, permafrost emissions seemed like a kind of obscure subject for experts. It would take thousands of years before anything much happened. But now we're seeing changes in a lifetime, and I find widely different predictions about the speed of permafrost thaw and when emissions will enter a feedback loop, etc. What are your predictions about timing?
It is true that the scientific community has known for some time that this permafrost carbon feedback will be there, but it is not there yet in the IPCC predictions. Like permafrost is mentioned in the latest IPCC report, but the permafrost feedback is not yet in the models which are used to create those emission scenarios. So it's always that policymaking is lagging behind what scientific community knows. And besides that, we have still great gaps in the knowledge when we think about these permafrost climate feedbacks. And also, it hasn't been fully incorporated to these coupled carbon climate models. And here we are talking about yet another feedback related to permafrost. So it's nitrous oxide emissions. It's a direct feedback to climate change, but also this permafrost nitrogen that has great implications for the carbon cycle. Like how quickly this carbon will be decomposing in permafrost soils. That is affected by nitrogen because it's a main nutrient. And also the potential for Arctic vegetation to take up atmospheric CO2, so this cooling effect to climate. We know that it will happen, but it will be also controlled by the nutrient availability, also by nitrogen. So there is a lot to find out.
You know, a couple of years ago, NASA announced the process of melting and breakup of the massive Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica was, quote, unstoppable, not a word they use very often. Can we now say the same about permafrost thaw?
Yeah, I think we could say that because it is a process that is ongoing. It has been documented well that permafrost is thawing and these abrupt thawing events and all kinds of disturbances like wildfires and this ground collapse related to thaw, they are becoming more common. And these natural processes, when they have been initiated, we are like accelerating them with our greenhouse gas emissions. But these natural feedback mechanisms, they are something we cannot easily affect. So when they are in progress, they will continue and they will feed back to the climate change, even if we stop all our emissions.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from Finland is postdoctoral researcher Maija Marashuk. And we're hearing about a little-known global warming gas that is increasing in the atmosphere as the planet thaws permafrost in the Arctic. Is the amount of nitrous oxide coming from thawing permafrost significant now? And is there a way to really measure and know that?
So this, I have to say that no one knows, because this topic has been so little studied. And there is not a good monitoring network for Arctic nitrous oxide emissions. So there are no continuous monitoring stations in the Arctic who are measuring nitrous oxide. So now we just rely on these few observations, I can say maybe dozens of studies who have looked into Arctic nitrous oxide. But there should be a lot of work done with this topic in near future. Also, since there are so few observations, we cannot really model these emissions. So that's something that we are currently doing. So we are trying to now incorporate the knowledge from the observations to these biogeochemical models and process models. So we are collaborating with modelers there. But currently those models cannot predict these emissions. So a lot needs to be done. And also we don't know so well the distribution of these landforms. For example, these Yeromato sites, how abundant they are in the Arctic. Because they can be quite small in the area, so they cannot be detected by many of the large-scale satellites. So this is something new, but definitely something that requires more research.
You also say nitrous oxide is, quote, a dominant contributor to ozone destruction in the stratosphere. Talk to us briefly about that.
Yeah, that's right. So this Montreal Protocol was a very efficient means to control the emissions of the ozone destruction substances. But N2O wasn't included in that protocol. And that's why currently when the CFC emissions have gone down, currently nitrous oxide is the most important substance which is causing ozone destruction in the stratosphere.
Your study found the right balance of soil moisture releases the most nitrous oxide, and I found myself wondering, well, how would that be affected if more Arctic precipitation comes as rain, as found in a recent study? Would that be a factor?
Yeah, that's true. So we have found, based on synthesis of nitrous oxide emissions from permafrost-affected soils, that intermediate soil moisture conditions promote N2 emissions. And that's the same as for the soils worldwide. And that is because then these processes that I mentioned before, so nitrification and denitrification, they can both occur at this intermediate soil moisture content. But it is very, very hard to say what is the net effect of this increased precipitation, because the local topography affects so much the local distribution of water within the landscapes. And also permafrost plays a big role, because permafrost prevents drainage, so it causes this waterlogging. So it can vary a lot in space what is the future of the Arctic when it comes to soil moisture content. But what I can say for sure is that any kind of big changes, they can boost these nitrous oxide emissions. So besides permafrost thaw, also draining of soils that has been previously very wet, that can boost N2 emissions when this nitrogen mineralization is increased.
In 2020, you co-authored a paper led by Carolina Voigt last year. Nitrous oxide emissions from permafrost-affected soils is the title. How does that paper fit in with your latest work?
Yes, that was the synthesis of all the nitrous oxide studies from permafrost-affected soils. And in this synthesis, we found out which were the most important factors leading to high nitrous oxide emissions from permafrost-affected soils. And these factors include, besides the intermediate soil moisture content that I mentioned already, this high nitrogen availability, and that's related to soil organic matter content. So organic soils like peat soils, they can boost high nitrogen availability. And also the quality of the organic matter. So carbon to nitrogen ratio, for example, is quite important determinant for nitrous oxide emissions. And besides these factors, also any kind of disturbances, like I mentioned before, so disturbed vegetation or lack of vegetation, that can boost nitrous oxide production, because when plants are not taking up any nitrogen from the soil, then more is available for soil microbes, including those producing nitrous oxide. So that was the knowledge that we used to build the hypothesis for this Yerevan work also. And our expectations were that we will find also the highest emissions from thawed Yeroma without any plants, so these recently thawed sites. And that's why we were quite surprised when we found the highest emissions from soils that had been already revegetated by some pioneering plants, so grasses and mosses.
So plants are playing a role. That's interesting. Maya, have you been to Siberia yourself to investigate the permafrost thaw and nitrous oxide?
Yes, I have been doing a lot of fieldwork in Arctic Russia. We are neighboring countries here, Finland and Russia. So the closest real waste permafrost areas to us are in Russia. So I have worked in Komi Republic in the European Russia, focusing on permafrost peatlands. And then I have went to Sakha Republic in northeastern Siberia to study these Yeroma sites.
And the thawing edge of permafrost is alien landscape to most of us. You are much closer to the Arctic Circle. Jyväskylä, Finland is just 481 kilometers or 299 miles south of that Arctic Circle dividing line. Tell us what it's like, this land of transition from long frozen ground to new landscapes.
Yes, this is something that we see also in Finland. So now I can tell about my last summer's fieldwork in northern Finland. I studied methane and carbon dioxide release from balsamires. And these balsamires are ecosystems which have the last bits of permafrost in Finland. So Finland doesn't have a lot of permafrost, but just sporadic permafrost, which is located in these peatlands, because when peat is dry, it isolates very well against warm temperatures, so it conserves the permafrost. But during the last decades, these balsamires have been degrading very rapidly, and I could really see it in the field. So I could see previous balsa vegetation, like these dwarf birches, which have been growing on the top of these frozen permafrost balsas. They were now underwater submerged. And I also discussed with my colleague who has been monitoring these balsamires during the past 10, 15 years. And he was indicating quite large areas that were still having permafrost 10 years ago, but now they were underwater. So it seems that we are losing the last bits of our permafrost, maybe even during my own lifetime, and they are gone.
So what do we need to do to better monitor, to really know how much dangerous greenhouse gases are coming out of thawing permafrost?
Yeah, according to my opinion, we need more of these long-term monitoring stations across the Arctic, which also include nitrous oxide measurements. Because when we are talking about something that hasn't been studied before, it is very, very difficult to know if these emissions have been always there or if they are there as a result of recent climate change. So we are lacking this base case scenario. And to observe how quickly this process is happening, we should start monitoring those things now, and then we could observe the changes. And also with this increasing availability of data, we could incorporate this knowledge to models that we could use to extrapolate these observations over large areas. And then we could start to talk about magnitude of these emissions. And then we could also compare it with carbon dioxide and methane. So currently, we don't know, and we cannot really estimate how large this feedback will be.
So Maya, do you think that permafrost thaw could become a major driver of climate change, say as big as disappearing sea ice?
Well, it's hard for me to evaluate between these two, but definitely this permafrost climate feedback, that can be substantial and that can be a significant addition to the global emission budget. So now we are trying to mitigate the human-related emissions. And we are talking about these emission budgets that we still have left for a certain level of warming, let's say 2 degrees of warming. And if we don't incorporate in those modeling predictions this permafrost carbon feedback, we might miss something. So we might actually need to mitigate our emissions even more if we don't account for these natural emissions that will take place, no matter what we do. So this is something that should be urgently done.
And what are you working on next?
I'm working on my data related to anaerobic decomposition processes that I have been studying 3 past years in University of Jyväskylä. That's data that has been collected and I will now publish next. But then I'm also very excited to continue on this permafrost nitrogen path, so trying to understand it even better, how large is the nitrous oxide feedback from permafrost and which are the controls of it. Also incorporating our observations to the models and these large-scale estimates, that's something that my group is currently working on.
We'll be watching this permafrost. From the University of Jyväskylä, Finland, we have been speaking with postdoctoral researcher Maya Marushak. You can find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Now that more of the Arctic Ocean is exposed to the sun every summer, could that affect weather in North America, Europe, Russia, Japan, or China? Does the record retreat of Arctic sea ice change weather in the mid-latitudes where billions of people live. Could that help explain strange weather in the Northern Hemisphere in recent years? We all want to know. In 2012, Dr. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers blew the doors off this question. Her paper was published the same year a giant polar storm broke up thin sea ice to create a record low that still stands in 2022. I interviewed Dr. Francis on that paper and again over the years. In 2017, we heard scientist Ivanis Ivanovic explain low sea ice was bouncing into the Pacific weather systems, bringing drought to California. That serious drought has persisted for years. But other serious scientists disagree, starting with Mark Cerise, the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. At the recent COP26 climate gathering in Scotland, senior research scientist Walter Meyer from that center gave a presentation at the Cryosphere Pavilion. Meyer called the connection between low sea ice and mid-latitude weather wishful thinking. Let's hear that. And then we go to yet another strong science paper showing low sea ice is definitely connected in some way to increasing wildfires in the western United States. Dr. Walt Meyer at COP26, November 5, 2021.
The other extremes that people talk about a lot is the mid-latitude connection, the connection between the Arctic and the changes in the sea ice and the Arctic warming and how that may affect the mid-latitudes. And this was a really big paper. Jennifer Francis and Steve Babris in Geophysical Research Letters published in 2012. And this, in our community, I'd say this made a bang. This was, you know, maybe not quite Einstein special relativity level, but this was a pretty big paper and really got a lot of attention. And it got a lot of attention in many ways. First, to kind of just quickly summarize their paper. The idea is, you know, you're warming the Arctic and you're losing sea ice, you're warming the Arctic. That's changing the balance between the warm the cold Arctic and the warmer mid-latitudes. And the jet stream kind of is essentially sped up by this balance, by the colder Arctic and the warmer mid-latitude. And you can break down, that can break down from time to time as cold air spills out and the jet stream gets kind of wavy instead of being more west to east flow. And the idea is that as you warm the Arctic, that balance is decreasing. So it's more easy for that outflow of that colder air, which is relatively less cold, to spill out and cause this wavy jet stream. And that does is that it weakens the jet stream. You get more of a north-south flow instead of a west to east flow. That leads to more extreme events. So when you have this wavier jet stream, that allows, you know, air from the south to more easily infiltrate north on the one side, or from the north to infiltrate south. So you can get cold air outbreaks, you can get heat waves. It also tends to slow storm tracks. So you get more extreme events, you get highs that get stuck and you get a heat wave and drought. You can get flooding, you get a storm that moves very slowly, as the jet stream doesn't move it out like it normally would. So that's kind of the idea behind that paper and behind the idea of this connection. And like I said, it got a lot of attention at the time, and it still gets a lot of attention. This is just this last winter. It certainly got a lot of press in the United States, especially when anything happens in Texas, it gets a lot of attention in the United States. But when they had the big cold outbreak, record low, it was certainly lowest in many, many years in February 2021, and it caused a big power failure, and people lost power and had pipes breaking and flooding, and I think there are people still recovering from that. So it had a big impact, and it really, it was a cold air outbreak, a very strong cold air outbreak. So, you know, even at this point, there was the connection, or people talked about this, is the warming Arctic and how that was one thing that could be contributing to that. So, you know, is there actually a connection? So this is where it's been an interesting discussion. There's been a lot of talk, but it stirred up a lot of talk and a lot of controversy, and particularly from kind of a skeptical community. There were a lot of people that really pushed back and still are pushing back against this, that they don't feel that this connection is really there. Looked at some data, some reanalysis data, and basically correlated these changes in the jet stream with the loss of sea ice and with the warming. And, of course, we all know correlation does not mean causation. A lot of folks, especially tropical climatologists, atmospheric dynamics folks that really felt that the Arctic is not a big enough player. It's a smaller area. There's not as much energy, that the tropics are really much more of an influence on the mid-latitudes compared to the Arctic. You know, it wasn't just this kind of like belief. There was papers that have been published that showed that, you know, no, there isn't a link. They don't find a link depending on what data is looked at and how it's looked at. So it's gone back and forth for many years. So, but nonetheless, this just came out in September. Judah Cohen's one of the folks that have been pretty big into the research and have found some links between the variability in extreme, especially in extreme winters. So this was in September, and saying, yes, there is a link. And, you know, I think one of the things that's a concern is it may be wishful thinking to some degree. Not to say that, like, Jennifer Francis and Steve Babris and others that have found links, that they're making things up or that they're not interpreting the data correctly. I mean, they're really great scientists. You know, I know Jennifer and Steve, and they do great work, and their, you know, their papers are good. But I think there are things that, depending on how you look at the data, you can come up with different answers. And one of the things is we're looking at extreme events, and extreme events are by their nature rare. And trying to detect a signal in extreme events and a record that's only about 40 years old is very difficult to do. If you've got something that happens only once in a century and it starts to happen and you've changed things, so now it happens once every 50 years, well, do you actually see that in a 40-year record? And again, there's this temptation, I think, to, in wishful thinking, to try to make that connection. And as a scientist, I think we have to always be careful about that. You know, one of the questions, as someone who works in the Arctic, you have presentations, especially for sea ice, people in Europe, people in the United States, in the lower 48 United States will say, well, you know, what does this mean for me? And, you know, for Greenland, Antarctica, ice sheet, sea level rise, you can make a connection. For sea ice, it can be hard to do. You know, you can talk about how sea ice is a bellwether. You know, the changes that are happening to sea ice are going to happen to the rest of the globe later. But there's that temptation or desire to really want to say, no, the sea ice loss is going to affect you directly. And so this is this mid-latitude teleconnection is a great thing to make that connection, to say that big snowstorm you had or that big heat wave, that was due to the sea ice or partly due to the sea ice or the Arctic warming. But, you know, it's hard to say if that data is really there yet. But I caveat that also with, you know, you're taking an area roughly the size of Western Europe, the Arctic Ocean, and you're changing it from almost completely ice covered year round to being almost seasonally ice free, at least during the summertime. You know, that's changing the albedo from, you know, 0.7, 0.8 to 0.1. That's a huge change over a big area. And I, you know, I just don't think you can make that big of a change without having some effect outside of the Arctic. And I think as the changes continue to occur, and as we get a longer record, I think we will start to see some signal outside of the noise. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. I do think that is true.
That was research scientist Walt Meyer from the National Snow and Ice Data Center giving a presentation at the Cryosphere Pavilion at COP26, November 5, 2021. Dozens of papers show links between missing sea ice and weather further south. I think Walt Meyer does a disservice by calling that link wishful thinking, like a sales pitch to interest big populations in the south. But that is just part of the downplaying of the real climate emergency typical at these COP meetings and their utter failure to control climate change over the last 25 years. Scientific caution may kill us yet. As Jennifer Francis points out, the observed links between low sea ice and jet stream distortion are just recorded facts. The tough part is to find the links or the drivers to the south. You are about to hear from the lead author of yet another new paper showing those connections from sea ice, this time to Western wildfires like the stunning record fires of 2021.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Record-busting, heartbreaking fires have become the new normal in the Western United States. Incredibly, New Science finds a driver far, far away. The paper is called Increasing Large Wildfires Over the Western United States Linked to Diminishing Sea Ice in the Arctic. How is that possible? The lead author is Dr. Yufei Zhu. Zhu led dozens of papers not just on fire science but on aerosols and air pollution, including in China. Until recently, he was a research scientist at the University of Washington and the Pacific Northwest National Lab. Now Yufei Zhu brings expertise to a new climate risk company called Kettle. Yufei, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Alex, for having me here.
Well, through smoke and flames and evacuations and closed highways, listeners on the West Coast feel like survivors. How serious is the increase in fire in the Western United States?
Well, I don't want to be a whistleblower of bad news, but those personal experiences and feelings are supported by statistical numbers in multiple fire data sets. And during the past few decades, both numbers and annual burn areas keep increasing over in the Western U.S. And the annual average burn areas of large wildfires grew by about 300% between the 1980s and 2010. In 2021, almost 9,000 wildfires burned more than 2.5 million acres in California, making it the second largest fire season right after 2020 on record in California's modern history. So these destructive fires have caused tremendous damage to people's lives and properties. And they also release a large amount of greenhouse gases and toxic aerosols into the atmosphere, posing a serious threat to public safety.
So what are the observed relationships between retreating sea ice in the Arctic Ocean and increasing fires in the Western United States?
The Arctic sea ice and regional fire danger conditions are negatively correlated in the observational data sets, with more fire favorable weather conditions in the Western U.S. following less sea ice in the Arctic and vice versa. In the meantime, more fires and larger burn areas are observed over the Western U.S. and these fire favorable conditions, like what we experienced in recent years. And this observed relationship motivated our study to investigate the underlying mechanism behind it.
Yes, and to tie these distant actions together so far apart, we need the concept of teleconnection. What is that and how real is it?
The term teleconnection refers to a linkage between weather changes occurring in widely separated regions, like what we are discussing here. And it's commonly applied to correlated atmospheric variability on monthly and longer timescales, reflecting large-scale changes in atmospheric waves and jet stream patterns that influence weather over a long distance away. The most famous teleconnection pattern might be the Southern Oscillation as the atmospheric component of El Niño, which links surface air pressure change between the eastern and the western tropical Pacific regions. And there are many other teleconnection patterns, such as the North Atlantic Oscillation and Pacific North American patterns, etc., all working together to shape weather conditions we're experiencing.
Does teleconnection operate high in the stratosphere or closer to us in the troposphere?
There are different atmospheric pathways being proposed regarding those teleconnections between the Arctic and the Mid-Atlantic regions. In our case, we observed a tropospheric pathway to link atmospheric change in the troposphere driven by Arctic sea ice change to fire weather change over the Western U.S.
When we try to anticipate the weather, the public has learned to watch ocean heat conditions in the eastern Pacific called either El Niño or La Niña. How does the Arctic sea ice teleconnection compare in its strength, so to speak, to that?
We do compare this Arctic-related teleconnection with ENSO as the leading mode of climate variability that ties to sea surface temperature change over the eastern Pacific Ocean, eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. And we found comparable impacts of these two teleconnections on regional fair weather between years with minimum and maximum sea ice. However, the strength of ENSO impacts vary year by year with no significant long-term trend, while the strength of the Arctic-related teleconnection shows an increasing trend due to continuously melting sea ice in a warming Arctic. And another difference between these two time connections is that the current generation climate models show better agreement on the variability and influence of the ENSO time connection than that of the Arctic time connection, suggesting a more challenging job to capture actually related time connection processes in those climate models.
If there's low sea ice during an El Niño year, which is expected to be hotter, does that indicate a possible super fire season? Why were the fires so bad in 2021, which was a La Niña year?
These climate factors could act in a constructive way with boosted effects, but they may also cancel out with each other to result in a neutral effect. The actual impact of either Arctic change or the El Niño-La Niña cycle depends on the location we're interested in. So, for example, it is true that El Niño winters are generally warmer than usual in most parts of Canada and the northern tier of the U.S. But for people living in the southern tier of the U.S., like California, they would feel a cooler and wetter winter during El Niño years. And during La Niña phase, these deviations from normal conditions are generally reversed. So therefore, a La Niña year could be bad for fire conditions with more hot and dry weather over in the southern U.S. due to a poleward shifted Pacific jet stream. This is also confirmed by our analysis in the supplementary information of our paper.
How do you know increasing amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are not directly responsible for heating and drying the West, rather than a relationship with Arctic sea ice levels?
The direct effects of greenhouse gases and other anthropogenic forcing were evaluated by comparing the AMAP and AMAP-PF forcing experiments from the CMAP-6 project. These two experiments share the same observation-based surface boundary conditions in sea surface temperature and sea ice, but with different anthropogenic forcing levels of greenhouse gases and aerosols in the atmosphere and magnitude change. So please note that the difference of these two experiments only isolates the direct climate effects of anthropogenic forcing agents left in the atmosphere and the land, while the indirect effects of these forcing agents are still preserved in the ocean datasets used to drive both experiments. Since the ocean absorbs more than 90% of the heat gained by our planet, it's not surprising that the changes in surface boundary conditions, including both SST and CS change, dominate atmospheric anomalies we saw in our simulations.
You do note in the paper increasing but still controversial evidence of emerging connections between high-latitude environmental change and mid-latitude weather extremes in both warm and cold seasons of the past few decades. Why is this link controversial?
That's because we still have inconsistency in climate modeling results when it comes to the climate impacts of high-latitude environment change. The observational data sets are also relatively short to draw a solid conclusion about actual polar impacts of Arctic change. And I think that's why a PEMAP project, which is short for Polar Amplification Model Intercomparison Project, has been initiated in the latest CMAP-6 project to try to narrow down modeling uncertainties and improve our understanding of this phenomena through a coordinated set of numerical models experiments.
And the well-known British researcher James Screen suggests the pattern you describe may change if sea ice is lost across the whole Arctic. A so-called blue ocean event could happen before the year 2050. Let me quote from Carbon Brief here. In the longer term, research by Screen suggests that as global temperatures rise, the risk of severe winters in North America is likely to fall, not rise, if greenhouse gases emissions continue to be high. So as the Arctic continues to warm and sea ice continues to melt, we can't expect its influence on mid-latitude weather to stay the same. Your comment, Dr. Zhu.
Dr. Screen is a well-respected researcher in this field who has done lots of work to resolve the uncertainty and the linearity of Arctic change and their global impacts. Many previous modeling studies have also suggested nonlinear responses in mid-latitude weather to Arctic sea ice forcing with different intensity. It might be true that the time connection relationship we're talking here will be totally different given an ice-free Arctic. But that's a different question from what we discussed in our paper, as we mainly focused on the past 4 decades as a transient time period when the Arctic is still experiencing drastic change. And Dr. Screen has also clarified the distinctions between these scientific questions in his Can It, Has It, and Will It paper published in 2015. Our paper was inspired by this insightful discussion by focusing on the first two questions from a retrospective view.
I'm reminded of Jennifer Francis of Rutgers. I asked her why some question her theory of changes in the jet stream due to Arctic changes, and she replied she was not advancing a theory. Her work announced relationships between observed data. How much does your new work depend on observations and how much on modeling?
I would say half and half, because all our model-based results were compared against observational and reanalysis data sets before and after removing the long-term trends.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Yufei Zhu. We are looking at how retreating sea ice in the Arctic leads to more wildfires in the West. Yufei, to what extent does your understanding of relationship between Arctic warming and mid-latitude changes build on the work of Radio EcoShock guest Dr. Judah Cohen?
Dr. Cohen is also a well-known scientist in this field, and I learned a lot from his work. I noticed he recently published a paper in Science to highlight the importance of stratospheric polar vortex stretching in linking Arctic variability with extreme winter weather in the U.S. So congratulations to him. Although in this study, we proposed a tropospheric pathway that is different from the stratospheric pathway he advocated. This may result from different seasons we studied. The stratospheric responses are usually more prominent in winter when the polar vortex is strong.
Well, the Arctic Ocean is a big place. It is the world's smallest ocean, but it is still 1.5 times the size of the United States. Is this teleconnection coming out of the Arctic as a whole or just part of it?
In our study, we found that the Pacific sector of the Arctic, near the Pacific Ocean, is the most significant region affecting fair weather conditions in downstream regions like the Western U.S.
And has the change in sea ice affected the length of the fire season as well? Does it extend it to spring or fall?
It could be. Exacerbated fair weather in fall and early winter could extend the length of the fire season, and that could be more dangerous since surface fuels have been fully desiccated after the preceding fire season during summer. And the windy conditions like Santana and the Diablo winds during fall and winter also contribute to this dangerous fair weather condition. So maybe that's why we saw more destructive fires during later seasons in recent years.
Well, yes, the recent urban firestorm near Boulder that burned over 1,000 homes, could that be related to conditions in the Arctic Sea too?
I think it's still too early to draw a solid conclusion here since it just occurred last week. And I need to do more data analysis before I can answer this question. And I'm sorry for the loss of people who suffered this disaster.
Do your results on declining sea ice cover and western fires apply to Canada as well?
Not really, because our modeling results suggest a warmer but wetter Canada, especially in the northwest coastal regions, which leads to suppressed fire activities for most Canadian areas. And similar changes are also evident in reanalysis-based composite results due to poleward shifted jet streams and storm tracks.
How detailed is this relationship? Does it work with data by decades or right down to the year? For example, the Arctic Report card from NOAA says sea ice records for 2021 are not record lows, but still among unusually low years. 2021 did see the lowest level of multi-year Arctic sea ice on record. If we know the amount of sea ice, say in June, can that actually help predict how bad the fire season will be in the West that summer and fall?
Yes. This seasonal linkage between the summer Arctic and the fall Western U.S. works on both interdecadal and interannual variations, as shown in our observation-based analysis. And one of our reviewers has also pointed out that this tenant connection relationship is helpful for improving fire predictability on seasonal timescales, but more work needs to be done to integrate this relationship with other influencing factors like atmospheric internal variability and ENSO impacts.
You mentioned that 2015 paper by Barnes and Screen. It was titled "The Impact of Arctic Warming on Mid-Latitude Jet Stream. Can it, has it, will it?" You find affirmative answers for can it and has it, but what about will it? Can it be worse? Yufei, do you expect the trend of more fire weather to continue into the future?
Yes, we actually answered the will it question in another paper published in 2019, and we predicted a near doubled annual burn area change in North America from the 2000s to the 2050s using the same fire model in this study. But that's a synthetic effect driven by all forcing factors, not just by the Arctic change discussed in this paper.
But a doubling of fire by 2050?
Yes.
Well, at least of fire conditions. So in 2021, the government's Oak Ridge National Lab published your proposal to create a new hybrid of machine learning and observations, a kind of open source mechanism for predicting wildfire risk. Is that going to happen?
I hope it will happen sooner than later, but it requires lots of effort with more resources that are not available at this moment because I recently changed my job.
Yes, you transferred to a San Francisco startup which offers new climate science to help reinsurance companies assess the real fire risk in the western U.S. Did I get that right? Is that what Kettle does?
Yes. Our goal at Kettle here is to balance risk in our changing climate, and we aim at improving fire prediction skills for a better understanding of fire risk in fire-prone regions like California. And we are developing new data-driven fire models based on process-based fire models and tons of observational data and advanced machine learning techniques to achieve this.
Just on a personal level here, a lot of Americans and Canadians used to love summers. Now they fear it, partly because of the fires, the threat of evacuations all the time, and air too smoky to breathe. What can we do to help keep that from getting worse?
I think it requires collaborative efforts of all people living on this planet to address this issue associated with global climate change. And the things we can do in our daily life could be more energy conservation and emission reduction. And we can also try a carbon neutral lifestyle by following the 3 R's principle to reduce our carbon footprint. And this 3 R's principle generally refers to reduce, reuse, and recycle.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, thank you all for listening. And it is my greatest pleasure to share with you about our work and thoughts in this program. And wish you all a happy and a healthy new year.
We've been speaking with Dr. Yufei Zhou, lead author of the recent paper in Nature Communications, Increasing Large Wildfires Over the Western United States, Linked to Diminishing Sea Ice in the Arctic. You can find links to follow up more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Yufei, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex, for the invitation. Yeah.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to this program, and my special thanks to all those listeners who support it. I can't do it without you. Be sure and tune in next week for more of Radio EcoShock. Please take care of your world.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Debt, the First 5,000 Years. David Graeber in conversation with Charlie Rose. The name of the anthropologist David Graeber came again into huge prominence at the end of 2021 when the book he co-authored with archaeologist David Wengrow was published. The dawn of everything, a new history of humanity, is described as a, quote,
dramatically new understanding of human history, challenging our most fundamental assumptions about social evolution from the development of agriculture and cities to the origins of the state, democracy, and inequality, and revealing new possibilities for human emancipation. End quote. Sadly, David Graeber is not present to enjoy the acclaim or to participate in debates about the many provocative ideas laid out in Dawn of Everything. He died only weeks after finishing the book on September 2, 2020. He was 59 years young. A professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics, Graeber taught anarchism and anti-capitalist movements. He was a hugely influential anthropologist, political activist, and public intellectual, said Professor Laura Baer, head of the anthropology department at the London School of Economics. Our community of staff and students will not be the same now he is gone, but we know his brilliant work will be read by generations to come. End quote. Born in New York, David Graeber was inspired by the activism of his working-class parents. His father was a printer in the days of offset presses and fought with the international brigades against General Francisco Franco's forces in the 1936-39 Spanish Civil War. His mother was a garment worker and homemaker. She played the female lead in the 1930s musical Pins and Needles, which celebrated the American labor movement. David Graeber was assistant professor at Yale University from 1998 to 2005. The university controversially decided not to renew his contract before he was eligible for tenure. Graeber moved into what he called academic exile in the UK, first to the University of London and finally the London School of Economics. David Graeber's 2011 book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years, was an anti-capitalist analysis that struck a chord with many readers in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Another response to the 2008 crisis was Graeber's own participation in the Occupy Wall Street movement that began in Zuccotti Park in New York City's Wall Street Financial District in September 2011, the same year Graeber's book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years, was published. It gave rise to the wider Occupy movement in the United States and other countries. In late December 2021, a long-lost interview showed up on YouTube that had been conducted by television journalist and talk show host Charlie Rose. There's no exact date associated with this 23-minute clip, but the topic is Graeber's book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Charlie Rose is asking Graeber about debt, Occupy Wall Street, democracy, and capitalism.
David Graeber is here. He is a longtime political activist. Bloomberg Businessweek has called him the anti-leader of Occupy Wall Street. On top of that, he is an anthropologist. Graeber is known for asking big questions about what exactly money is and how it affects our society. I am pleased to have him back at this table as part of an ongoing conversation about government and capitalism and economic systems. So welcome. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Tell me how we ought to understand, in your judgment, debt. Your book is titled Debt, The First 5,000 Years.
It is.
I first got the idea of writing the book because I was puzzled by the strange moral power debt has. The fact that it can be used to justify things that it's you would think couldn't be justified in any other way. It all starts, actually, when I'm having a conversation with a liberal lawyer in London about IMF austerity packages and campaigns against them, which I was involved in the global justice movement, and talking about deaths of babies in Africa, you know, when people have to cut medical services and the results are catastrophic. And she asked, well, yes, but what did you propose to do about it? And I said, well, we thought they should cancel the debts. And she was shocked. She was, but, you know, they borrowed the money. I mean, surely you have to pay your debts. Mm. And that line, it just seemed so simple and powerful. I mean, and I thought to myself, well, under what other circumstance would a very nice person like this actually support something that would lead to the deaths of thousands of babies? What is it about debt that it just seems like morality is a matter of paying your debt? So it's the very essence of morality, despite the fact that the results are often things that you couldn't morally justify in any other possible way. And I realize that this problem has been around for a very long time. It's one reason why the book has a 5,000-year scope. This kind of argument has been going on apparently since we have written records. You have people on the one hand saying morality is just a matter of paying your debts, and on the other hand saying, on the other hand, people who lend money are basically evil. And both those threads seem to run throughout world history. So I started thinking about what debt is, and I finally came to the conclusion that debt is really best conceived as a perversion of a promise. The moral power comes from the fact that it is a promise, and promises are always considered sacred. In a way, our society is built on a series of promises we make to one another. But at the same time, it's a very peculiar type of promise, because it's a promise that has been made impersonal by a kind of a combination, perverted, you might even say, by a combination of math and violence. And generally speaking, when mathematics and violence come together, bad things tend to ensue. But in this case, the effect is to make a promise transferable to others. In a way, that's what money is. It's a transferable promise. Money is just debt.
When you look at Europe today, mm-hmm. there are certain countries that look down on other countries because they believe they have, in their economic life, been frugal,
mm-hmm.
And others have, in their economic life, been profligate, and now they're being asked to bail out the other. And so there's some political fallout from that.
Right. It's another perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's a moral language. It has nothing to do with economics. It's not like Greek people work less than Germans. As a matter of fact, someone did a study and discovered that Greek workers actually work more hours than German ones. It's not like Greek people are getting better social services than Germans are. They're getting less good social services. So it's not like they've been having a party and not paid for it. The real origins of the Greek crisis go back to military and security spending. They have the highest military and security spending in Europe. But somehow this is the collective responsibility of the entire Greek people. And in German media, they actually use phrases like debt sinners. It's totally moralized.
And in fact, you suggest that in certain languages, the word for guilt and the word for debt is the same.
It's a really fascinating thing. When I started reading religious texts, you find this over and over again. You find it in the Vedic literature and the Brahmanas. The word for debt and sin and guilt in Sanskrit is the same word. In Aramaic, actually, the famous forgive us our trespasses, in original Aramaic, it's forgive us our debts, just as we forgive those who owe us money. Of course, the implicit message is, well, you don't actually forgive those who owe you money, do you? So, in effect, we're all sinners. But here's the weird thing. You always see them start by saying, yes, debt, sin, guilt, they're the same thing. Morality is just paying your debts. Your life is a debt you owe to the gods, so forth and so on. But then they back off. And if you read it very closely, they're actually saying, except not really. Actually, in the Hindu scriptures, for example, you can only really repay the debt by realizing the debt doesn't exist, by becoming the thing you repay your parents by becoming a parent, for example. In the Bible, it's not paying your debts that's sacred, it's forgiving debts, it's canceling debts, jubilee. So the question is, why do they have to start with that if they don't really believe it?
You also suggest that China, because it holds so much American debt, it's the first stages of a very, very long process in some minds to reduce the United States to a client.
Well, this is something that China has done throughout world history. So it would be hard to imagine that some people there aren't thinking along those lines. That's the way they dealt with the northern barbarians, as they always called them, scary, militaristic foreigners, which is undoubtedly how they see us. You shower them with gifts. You get them dependent. They had this tribute trade where they always gave more to their vassals than they got back. But the idea was, on the one hand, to spoil them, to make them complacent and dependent, and gradually then move in and absorb them, or can turn their military prowess to your advantage rather than against you.
And you have said that the intellectual consensus has been that we no longer, in this society, ask big questions. What big questions should we ask?
Well, I thought about that after 2008. There was a moment where people were questioning everything. The Economist ran a headline saying, capitalism, was it a good idea? Everybody started asking, well, what is a financial system actually for? What's an economy actually for? What is debt? Why do we have to pay it?
Because they've seen it either collapsing or near collapse.
Exactly. And all the stories we had been told, that markets run themselves, that the people running them are these incredible geniuses, or the only people who are competent to run an economy, turned out not to be the case. So there seemed to be a moment where people were willing to start asking questions, and it was almost as if a panic set in. After 2 or 3 weeks, it was just like, no, just keep calm and carry on, nothing to see here, just move along. And we've just been trying to pretend nothing happened ever since, which of course is going to be disastrous, because something like that is going to happen again. They didn't resolve any of the underlying issues. They just put a big Band-Aid up.
What was the underlying issue? Was it debt?
Well, they certainly haven't resolved the debt crisis. Right. There's a series of underlying issues. I mean, that's why you ask the big questions, is to figure out what the underlying issues are.
Yes. Yeah.
But certainly debt as a problem has not been resolved at all. We've been skating from one debt crisis to another since the 70s, really. For the first 20, 30 years, it was largely confined to the global south, so we didn't pay a lot of attention. Now it's kind of come back on us, partly because the global south successfully resisted. The IMF was kicked out of East Asia. They were kicked out of Latin America. For a while, it looked like organizations like that weren't even going to survive. And now, of course, they found a new home in Southern Europe.
Talk about Wall Street movement. And I mentioned your prominence in that. Tell me how you saw your role.
I saw it mainly as a generational bridge. I'd been involved in the global justice movement. And the funny thing about activist generations, people burn out very quickly. It's very intense. So after 3 or 4 years, you show up, it's all new faces. I'd been away largely in London. I came back to New York. I had a year of leave. And it was all new people. And you know how it is. For a lot of people in the global justice movement, at least, we were sort of banging our heads against the wall for years and gradually giving up. And it's like, this year, it's going to really be back, you know? It's going to happen. This dream we had of direct democracy sort of becoming contagious and sweeping the nation, changing our very idea of what politics were. We all had an idea that it could happen, and we just kept getting our hopes up and having them dashed. And I had a sense this time that it was real. So I think a lot of what I did was just call up my friends and say, no, it's really going to happen this time. Take my word for it. Come up, come back. Come back from the farm in upstate New York or wherever you are now and do some trainings, do medical trainings, legal trainings, affinity groups. You know, teach people our old tricks, because there's a bunch of young people who are really motivated and something's really going to happen.
And is it?
Well, I mean, we never expected anything like what happened. I mean, 500 occupations or something like that in a matter of months. Things happening all over the globe. Obviously, something that explosive, it's not going to continue like that at that pace for years on end. I mean, every movement has its ups and downs, and it was so meteoric at the beginning that, you know, obviously there's going to be a certain settling down, and we settle in for the long haul, because, I mean, social movements don't actually achieve things in a year. They need a decade, usually, to really change the face of society.
Are there any similarities between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party?
No, I think that the Tea Party represent one aspect of the general disillusionment that Americans have with the political system. I think that one thing that...
So they share that.
Yeah, we share a sense that politicians are basically corrupt, that what we call a democracy is either dysfunctional or not a democracy at all. I don't think it's a democracy at all.
What would you call it?
Kleptocracy? I could think of a lot of phrases, some of them more impolite. Fraud. I mean, I think that what we have is not a democratic system. It's a system of legalize bribery. In most countries, if you give politicians money to influence their vote, that's called bribery. It's corruption. It's illegal. We've managed to eliminate the corruption problem largely by legalizing it. It's not illegal.
But this is not the only place where they're not people from the private sector don't give to political parties or give to the electoral process.
True. Corruption exists in many places. But, I mean, it's systematic. And most places, it's not nearly so uncontrolled. People are still put in jail. For example, in Italy, one of the platforms of a populist party, the Five Star Movement, is that any politician who's gone over a certain level of the criminal process for corruption charges should not be allowed to hold office, and that's about a third of politicians.
Yeah, but politicians go to jail here for accepting. No, they do.
Oh, you know, yes. That. I mean, of course, they have to leave some things illegal.
Yeah.
But the basic
and
idea.
And lobbyists go to jail, too.
It's true. There's always there's limits to every system, and that's how you can say we're not corrupt. You have a few things that are just so out of line that you can arrest people for it. But the fact is, I mean, it's money that drives the system. Most people don't vote, and most people don't vote because their votes don't matter. My vote has never mattered. I'm from New York, so my vote has never mattered.
Because New York, in the end, like Texas, doesn't matter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So when you have
swing states that matter.
So how are you going to call it a democracy if most of the electorate actually has no influence on the
election? So what
should
you do? Change the electoral system and then you fix it?
I myself take a long-term view. I'm an anarchist. I believe that I'd like to see a genuinely free society. And what I see as a genuinely free society is one without systematic bureaucracies of violence. So I'm against states. I'm not here to tell people what to do, but I do, as a sociologist, say, well, this is not a democratic system in any sense.
You are an anarchist in the world of ideas or more?
Oh, more. I mean, one thing that we felt very important at Occupy was creating institutions that could exist in a free society. And that's critical. We don't want to enter into the political process, not just because it's inherently corrupt, and unless you have $1 billion, you're not on a level playing field, because if you engage with that system, you've become part of it. And as a result, that space that where you can try to imagine what real democracy would be like almost completely evaporates. People start acting like politicians. They say one thing to please their funding base, another thing in private. They calculate how they can influence important political actors. Everything gets organized around personalities. It loses everything that really made this thing vital and important to us, which was the chance to experience what genuine democratic decision-making could be like.
When do you look back at our own history and say we, quote, lost it?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's not as if we started as a democracy. I mean, I always like to point out,
less than a democracy because women and African Americans couldn't vote.
Well, yes, indeed. And as a matter of fact, when we started, I always point this out, that there's nowhere in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence does it say anything about America being a democracy. Those guys were explicitly against democracy, and they said so. John Adams was like quite up front. He said, we can't have a majority vote. There's 9 million people with no property, maybe 1 or 2 million people with property. If we allowed majority vote, the first thing they'd do is they'd abolish the debts, and then they'd, redistribute the land. He said this. So they were anti-democratic. They set up the system, which was sort of, their ideal was Republican Rome rather than democratic Athens.
Let me come back to a couple of points.
They renamed it a democracy in the 1830s, and ever since we're supposed to call it that, but that's never what it was supposed to be.
What's the relation between democracy and capitalism?
It's an interesting question. Again, it depends on how you define democracy. If you define it the way we now do, is this Republican system of government, which is originally created to suppress democracy, well, they work quite well together. I think that it would not be possible to have a genuinely democratic society, that is, one in which people actually deliberated collectively and solved their decisions in a reasonable fashion through public assemblies and various other democratic forms, and you'd have to come up with more complicated things when you're on larger levels of administration. There's lots of ideas about what a really democratic society would be like. I don't think that would be possible with vast inequalities of wealth. I think that, in a way, the founders were right when they said, if we have a system where a few people have all the wealth and other people don't, you can't open it up to everyone. You have to have a situation where people are not forced to pursue economic interests because of their desperate situation before people can sit around and think reasonably about what's best for everyone. But I think it's possible to achieve that. Mm-hmm.
You also said that there's good reason to believe that in a generation, capitalism will not exist. One, how are we measuring a generation? And two, you know, what does it mean capitalism will not exist?
Well, I'm simply thinking of it this way. Capitalism, I mean, there's a million definitions of what it is, right? But they all seem to agree that it depends on growth, that if you don't have 5% national growth a year, you're not really pulling it off.
Well, wait a minute. There are lots of countries, almost all of Europe.
I know. And it's
and the United States.
We're in the doldrums. Everybody says that.
And there are few. And China's going from double digits down to 8 or maybe 7 even.
Precisely.
Depending on whose prophecy you believe. But
which is one reason why we have this financialization and debt crisis.
And Brazil, which all these emerging nations are finding some slippage in their annual growth as well.
Absolutely. This is the point that I'm making. For capitalism to be viable, it depends on this kind of growth. If that growth ends, and it has to, because frankly the planet can't actually sustain
the other argument is simply that in fact quite the reverse is happening. What's happening is the rise of the middle class around the world is creating a bigger demand, and therefore capitalism will, quote, flourish.
Well, okay, the problem with that is resources. You don't actually have enough metal in the crust of the earth for everyone in China to have a car. So the standards that we've come to expect...
So you build plastic cars.
Well, that's petroleum product.
Okay.
We're clearly hitting some kind of limits, and global warming is just the most obvious example of that. People are sounding greater and greater alarm bells every day about this sort of thing.
But then you make the argument... Can capitalism and environmental standards coexist?
Well, this is the interesting question. Or capitalism, if it demands a certain level of growth, can it coexist? We all thought so. I'm going to be honest. People in the global justice movement imagined, when we sort of made up our plans, because we had to think, well, what's their plan so we can counteract it? We all thought green capitalism was going to be the big thing, that they were going to go from the current sort of debt-based neoliberal phase to this new green capitalism and declare an emergency and use it to appropriate even more resources to themselves. And we were kind of shocked that they didn't do it. And this is what I mean by people are incapable of thinking big. We can't come up with an effective response unless the other side comes up with their evil plan. And they don't really seem to be able to do so. There's this incredible lack of the ability to come up with visionary solutions, which world leaders used to have. Some of those visionary solutions were quite horrible, but at least they were capable of doing so.
Do you use the word anarchist to define yourself because you don't like any other word? I mean, you don't want to look at communism, you don't want to look at socialist, you don't want to look at fascist, you don't want to look at any other word that might describe a political philosophy, so therefore you settle on anarchy?
No, I settle on anarchy because I don't think anarchism is crazy. I think that very few people dislike the idea that everybody could cooperate and get rid of police and prisons and just all behave reasonably with one another.
So your definition of anarchism, it is simply, is more like libertarianism?
Well, the word libertarianism was actually coined by anarchists because people associated anarchists with bomb throwers, and then the right appropriated it. But I think we also disagree with contemporary libertarians because they think that there will be capitalism and markets in a free society, and we feel that there won't. I mean, it's a matter of prophecy. They seem to think that, you can have this island where there's no state, but everybody who has property just sort of hires everybody who doesn't. And even if we can have an island over here where everybody has sort of equal division of basic needs and carries on from there, we think that all the proletariat from their island will come to ours, and therefore it won't work.
I'm going to wind this up in the following way. I'm looking for a better way to ask this, but I don't have a better way.
Okay.
So what after capitalism, in your judgment, what exists and what do we call it?
Well, okay, here's the problem, I think. I'm not so worried that capitalism will survive. Everything comes to an end. This system shows all signs of not being able to fix itself.
But it wasn't so long ago when Francis Fukuyama was writing The End of History because they thought exactly the opposite.
I know. Isn't it remarkable how quickly things change? So here we have the system we thought was going to last forever, self-destructing before our eyes. What I'm really worried about is the next thing they come up with might be even worse. It could be some sort of fascistic...
Who is they?
Well, whoever ends up picking up the pieces. I mean, there are models out there, the sort of populist, authoritarian, sort of China model is very popular in the third world right now. I think it's all the more important to develop actual democratic alternatives. I mean, so when people ask me what's my alternative to capitalism, I call it democracy. Why not have economic democracy? Have a system where people collectively make decisions that affect their own lives. How that's going to work out?
So you don't think we've ever made democracy work?
We've come close every now and then, but no. As I say, the system was not set up to be a democracy. I think democratic elements emerged. Politicians found is that ordinary Americans loved the idea of democracy, even though politicians at first hated it. So they kind of came around.
Both have friends, maybe not the same friends,
right.
who lived in communist countries, and they'd say, communism didn't fail. We never got it right.
Sure.
You're saying we've never gotten democracy right.
I think people were really even trying, to be honest, most of the time. I think there's nothing that terrifies the people running the political system in America more than the danger of democracy breaking out. If you look at the violent reaction they had to a bunch of camps in public parks, which weren't really hurting anybody, right? People were shot with plastic bullets, tear gassed, put in the hospital regularly. I mean, we still can't meet in public without being physically assaulted, despite the fact that we have this thing called the First Amendment, which appears to have been repealed now, saying that this is a fundamental democratic right. Why did they react in this panic fashion? I think the only explanation is they're terrified of real democracy breaking out.
Gillian Tett, who all of you who watch this program know, or most programs I do, because she is often a guest, says about this in the Financial Times, fresh, fascinating, Graeber's book is not just thought-provoking, but also exceedingly timely. His sweeping narrative history essentially argues that many of our existing ideas about money and credit are limited, if not wrong. That from Gillian Tett. I thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
That was an interview of anthropologist, author, and professor at the London School of Economics, David Graeber, talk show host Charlie Rose on PBS and Bloomberg, asked him about his 2011 book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. The publication at the end of 2021 of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, that David Graeber co-authored with David Wengrow, raised the interest in Graeber's prior work, and in early January, this long-lost interview reappeared on YouTube. Sadly, David Graeber is not present to enjoy the acclaim or to participate in debates about the many provocative ideas laid out in The Dawn of Everything. He died only weeks after finishing the book on September 2, 2020. He was 59 years young. This program is part of a celebration of the connection of David Graeber's work to the real-life events of our time. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.